Some things shouldn't be transparent, like stop signs. But what you pay for should always be clear, like Hiller's True Transparency Pricing, always clearly itemized and never any hidden fees. Because you have the right to know what you're paying for. For more information, visit happyhiller.com/true-transparency-pricing. Happy you'll be, or the service is free.
Call the Happy Face Truck today.
104.5 The Zone, hitting the links with you on a Saturday morning. This is Talking Golf with Virgil Herring on 104.5 The Zone.
Good morning. It's time to talk a little golf. And you are listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone. Another great show lined up for us today. Scott Wilkerson, PGA Tour rep for UST Mamaia, will be joining us to talk about fitting tour players, the new shaft that UST's got out called the Link. Give us all the details on that. And just the general information of that we'd like to see on the tour about, you know, what are they looking at to take their game to the next level? Jim Nugent will be joining us at the 15 to rate Monday's headlines on Saturday morning, as we have many things non-golf course related to discuss, as well as what's going on at Riviera. But to start our show off, we're having one of the finest analytics people in the country, Jake Nichols from the 15th Club, and the only person I've ever had on my show that would know exactly where I come from. Jake, how are you today, buddy?
I'm doing good, Virgil. Thanks for having me on.
Emmitsburg, Maryland. You're the only person I've ever had on here that would know where Littlestown, Pennsylvania is.
Yeah, there we go. Got to represent Southern PA.
Got to love it. Well, one of the most important reasons why I love to have you and all the other analytics people on here is that it's a great way for my listeners to understand the importance of what it takes to play better golf. And one, there's very few people in the world that do it better than you, if any. And when we're talking about the like constant improvement, the concrete improvement on the course, what separates the best iron players from the average iron players? And what is the best, you know, for putters and what makes them better than the average putters?
Well, it's always less than anyone thinks when we present this stat to them, whether it's a player or a coach, manager. And what separates the best iron players in the world from average on tour is only 3 feet on average on their proximity. So we're talking, you know, the best on tour right now is probably Justin Thomas, and he's hitting his average shot only 3 feet closer to the pin than the tour average. And if you get to some superhuman seasons from Tiger Woods, he might stretch it to more like 4 or 4.5 feet. But that tiny margin is what separates the best from average, leveraged over every shot in the round.
That's interesting. So would you say that then that makes the biggest difference on the scoring shots, or does it make the biggest difference on the longest clubs coming into par threes and second shots on par fives?
Right, yeah. The gap does widen quite a bit. If you look at just long shots, so the 200-plus-yard shots, the gap there is more like 4 or 5 feet for the best players. So, yeah, it does place additional leverage on those type of shots to make up the margin.
And when you think of, like, what the average golfer out there, when they're talking about making their game better, it's almost just as much to easy to stay as stop trying to make birdies and stop making bogeys. What's the mindset that you're looking for out of your analytics to help people play better golf?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Certainly for amateur players, you know, it's a lot of the time it's more about getting out of your way. You know, stop trying to do too much, stay in your lane, so to speak. Because even if you look at the tour average player, a shot from 200 yards in the middle of the fairway, only just over half of those players are getting the ball in the green even. And the median shot, the middle shot of all those, is around 33 to 34 feet. So those guys even if the tour player can't do it, you know, just getting the ball in the green for a good amateur player is more than enough from that distance. So kind of trying to stay in your lane and don't try to do too much, hit it too close.
Yeah, I think that what's so interesting and important for the work that you do is the fact that almost everybody that I talk to, an aspiring junior golfer, college players that I work with, what have you, even the tour players in some regards, until they get people with you like you in their court, is that they have an incorrect perception of how close they hit it to the hole. And I think that's so important for people to understand that from 200 yards, the average tour player is barely hitting the green more than 50% of the time, and the average proximity of the hole is 33 feet. Most people would not believe that, and that's the thing that I think is important for you to pass on.
Yeah, and we get a had a blog post at 50's Club over the winter break where we showed from 100 yards even from the middle of the fairway. Now, that's green light for anybody who plays golf. You know, that's the place to score. And even there, tour players, the middle shot is about 15 or 16 feet. And only 25% of them even get it inside 10, 12 feet. So you have to set the expectations, I guess, is what I'm saying, at the right level. You know, and understand, you know, you're not going to hit these shots as close as you might want to on every single shot.
Yeah, no kidding. Talk to us about the putting. Because another really important piece is that many people spend a lot of time working on their stroke and trying to make sure that they got a perfect stroke, hit it in the center of the putter face. But distance control is often maligned, and I almost call that the most important of the fundamentals. What are you seeing when it comes to putting that separates the best from average?
Yeah, I think another one that kind of blows people's minds is if you have a 50-foot putt, which for an amateur is, you know, it is not a crazy range to have. You have a couple of those every single round. Less than half the tour players, are even getting those inside 3 feet for what you might consider a tap-in or a gimme. So if those players, less than half of them are getting those putts inside 3 feet, then that just speaks to how important speed and distance control in those shots is, you know, to consistently be able to give yourself the easy putts. Because what we see, if you look at putting make percentages, if you go from 3 feet to even 5 feet, you're talking about a drop of 20%. If you go from 3 feet to 8 feet, you're talking about a drop of over 40% on make percentage. So cutting that 1 foot, 2 foot off on those lag putts is really important.
Did you hear that out there? That is huge. Work on your speed, especially outside of, I'd say, 20 feet is speed, speed, speed. Well, we're currently speaking with Jake Nichols from the 15th Club. Follow him on Twitter at the 15th Club and at J Nichols. And I think it's important to also note that 15th Club played an integral role in the Ryder Cup as you represented or helped the European squad with all of their analytics to help them to victory. And it's fascinating work that you guys do. And, you know, as we spent a lot of time talking about the best players in the world, and Jordan Spieth has certainly been one of those, but his game has been struggling significantly. Not significantly, but compared to what we've been used to seeing for almost a year now. What have you seen with Spieth's game that's gone, you know, sideways? And he seems to be back in action because he led after the first round through the Riviera, and he played well the last couple of weeks. What's your take on Spieth?
So it seems like his decline, if you can call it that, from the number one player in the world heights, has kind of been in two parts over the last year. So the first part of the season last year, up until about the summer, June, it was really struggles with the putter, which for someone like him, who, especially outside of 10 feet, was probably the best in the world on the greens, you know, that was really atypical for him. But every other club in the bag, he was hitting pretty well, driving the ball well, approach shots and all that. But around the summer, he began to improve his putting yet again, went back to the previous heights that he was at for the most part with the putter. But ever since then, the long game has really suffered. He's been below average for the past 6 or 7 months in shots off the tee. He's been about average on approach shots, and for someone who's so good around the greens, he's only been about average around the greens inside 50 yards. So really, really a tale of two chunks of the season, really, for him, of, you know, doing damage control on different parts of his game.
It's interesting because a lot of the tour players are starting to really fall in love with the analytics, but I find it interesting as I've worked with some of them, they get on a spiral. They think that their ball striking is not good enough, and they're always trying to either hit it farther or work on something that's so only going to make a half a percent difference. And it seemed like he had veered off the rails a little bit with his golf swing stuff, but his putter definitely put him in a tough spot when it mattered most. So I'm interested to see how it goes, because wasn't it true that when he won two majors a couple of years ago, his ball striking numbers were way better than most people gave him credit for? Isn't that accurate?
100%. And I think a lot of that was driven by, he's never a player who's looked really good in the greens and regulation set for whatever reason. But like you said, his long game numbers in 2015, in 2017, again, when he won the British Open, he was the best iron player on tour that year.
Wow, that's interesting. And a very hot topic in an article that you put together recently was, you know, Tiger Woods Riviera is the only golf course that Tiger Woods has not won on when he's played more than five times. And that was so fascinating, the article you wrote, because I never would have thought, as I played Riviera, I didn't really pay that close of attention. Of course, I didn't play it in tour conditions, that the greens and regulation number on the tour are so low compared to the norm. Talk to us about how Riviera has kind of stymied Tiger Woods.
Well, yeah, the greens and regulation numbers there are typically some of the lowest across any course, you know, for the season on the PGA Tour. And that's largely a product of, it's really rare to have a club inside 125 yards, really, on the par fours there. Even the shorter par fours, you have to lay back quite a ways, so you're hitting difficult shots in. And so the thing about Riviera is, Tiger has not played poorly there, but it has made him less superhuman, I guess, than his peak. He's been merely good there. I think he's been the third best scorer in the last 20 years there in terms of just scoring average against the field. So it's more a fact that Riviera has brought him down to, you know, a mortal level than that he's really struggled there.
That's interesting, because it also shows that the people who win there really do a great job of gaining strokes around the green. And for the longest time, you could argue that he was the greatest ever. And if not, he'd be in a short list with Seve and, you know, Jose Maria Olazabal and Phil. But it's definitely stymied him. And maybe it probably has a lot more to do with where he's missed it under the gun. But very interesting there as well. The last piece I wanted to discuss with you is your work on the 10th hole at Riviera, which is really, if you've never been there, is one of the more perplexing short par fours in the world, where I personally got extremely lucky to make a par, and Phil made the most entertaining par that didn't count in the history of golf this week. Talk to us about what you found on the 10th at Riviera.
So we've really seen a transformation in terms of strategy that the tour players are adopting on that hole. For the longest time, the numbers suggested and the player's strategy suggested that laying back as far left as possible to maybe about 75 yards. If you're familiar with the hole, for the listeners, right behind the leftmost fairway bunker, that was sort of the optimal way to play the hole. And then in the last few years, players have come around to actually know it's better to drive it past that fairway bunker to the left side of the green and leave themselves a little pitch forward. And what we've seen is pretty striking. Since the tour began collecting the numbers, in 2014, only a third of the field hit driver on that hole. And I just looked at the numbers from the first 1.5 rounds this year, and it was already up to 81% of players hitting driver on that hole. Now, some of that might be conditions, but even if you look at the past couple of years, the number of players hitting driver there has doubled. So they're getting more aggressive, there's fewer players laying back, and there's more who are aiming down the left side of that hole, and trying to just generate a little pitch up for birdie.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of that is because of the great work that you do. And the people that break down your work to help with strategy, like Scott Fawcett does, I think that that's what we're starting to see, is people using your great information to mathematically tear apart golf courses to the best of their ability, to give them the greatest probability, no guarantees in golf, but the greatest probability to shoot the lowest score. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on my show, Jake. How can my listeners learn more about your great work?
So they can follow me on Twitter at J-A-L Nichols, N-I-C-H-O-L-S, and they can follow the 15th Club at 15th Club. We normally push out at least one blog post every week to break down some part of the game, whether it's allowing you to benchmark yourself against tour players, breaking down the 16th hole at Phoenix, the 10th hole at Riviera. So a lot of good content there.
Well, I'm super excited to have you on, buddy. I hope to have you on multiple times this year to help pass on your information. Best of luck to you, and I'll talk to you soon, okay?
Thanks a lot, Virgil. Have a good one.
My pleasure. All right, we return. We're going to write Monday's headlines, so stick around. You're listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone. Welcome back. You're listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone. If you'd like to get involved with the show, hit me up on Twitter. I am at Virgil Tourspin. So this time every Saturday morning, we write Monday's headlines on Saturday morning with the founder of Global Golf Post, Jim Nugent. Nuge, how are you today, buddy?
Virgil, good morning. Thank you for having me on today.
My pleasure. Well, it's like the fourth week in a row where our headlines starting our conversation have nothing to do with the golf course. And I find the most compelling one, although most people might think it's Kuchar, is this Lucy Lee scenario where the USGA decided to keep her eligible as an amateur with a little slap on the wrist warning. Give us your inside info on the Lucy Lee deal and how she maintained her amateur status.
Well, it's a complicated saga. I've changed my opinion on it over the last couple of days. I think the USGA got it right in this instance. They reprimanded her, and she retains her amateur status and therefore can continue to compete as an amateur and, most importantly, play in the inaugural Augusta National Women's Amateur in 6 or 8 weeks. But the disturbing thing is how long it took to arrive at this decision. From the time that the breach of amateur status was evident, which is in the first week of January, until here, mid-February, it just took too long. And I think the reason for that is that the family resisted cooperating with the USGA. And I think the USGA could have and probably should have immediately moved to suspend her amateur status to force the family into a situation where they had to be cooperative and demonstrate that there was no intent, that it was an honest mistake by a 15-year-old girl. Letting it go on as long as it did, I think, was kind of a black eye for the USGA. But at the end of the day, I think their decision was reasoned. I think it was fair, but not a great way for us to start the new year in golf, to be sure.
Yeah, no kidding. And I find it funny. An article that I read stated that Apple was not very cooperative either in the proceedings. So it was interesting how much resistance they face from the family and from Apple, which is pretty fascinating in its own right. But either way, she retains her amateur status, and good for her because she's such a spectacular player and she's still so young. It's so hard to believe that she's the age that she is, as good as she is, because she was here in Tennessee for the women's amateur last year. And a couple of the players that I teach said that she was like a machine, unbelievable, and played. She was only trailing one time, and that was on the 18th hole of the match that she lost, which is pretty hard to believe. She's a great player.
She's a talent, to be sure, for a 15-year-old, but she's a tiny little girl. She has an awful lot of growing up to do. No one has any expectation that she's going to play college golf, and so she'll likely turn pro at 18. And what she's going to find is that for a professional, she's not sneaky short. She's short off the tee. And say what you will about, you know, how far the golf ball goes and the men's power game. If you can't get it out there in the woman's professional game off the tee, you're going to have a very, very short career. And so her joy in the game, her age, all those things are to be admired, but her long-term future is really very gray.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. You know, before we get on the Kuchar thing, there was an interesting conversation I was in on social media about the yardage that the LPGA Tour players play, although significantly shorter than the PGA Tour players play. It does not show up that way when it comes to the length that they're playing comparatively when it comes to irons hit into the green.
as many of the female players are hitting hybrid and longer irons in. And up until this past week at Riviera, I'm not sure Dustin Johnson's four iron had ever gotten a piece of grass on it. So the scoring is interesting because there aren't many people, aren't many girls on the LPGA Tour that bomb it at the same rate that Rory and Dustin and Cameron Champ and what have you do. So there's, the scoring is less profound because they're not hitting wedges like the men are, even though they're playing from shorter distances. And I'm wondering if the LPGA Tour is going to begin to recognize that and move it accordingly. What do you think about that, Nuge?
I don't think they will, Virgil, although I don't have any great insight into that. I don't think they want to penalize lack of athleticism. I think they want to reward athleticism. And athleticism in all sport means performing at a higher level. And so the girls that are fit, that are big and strong, I think are going to continue to be rewarded with their distance, provided that they can keep it, you know, in the short grass and not throw it all over the golf course.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to make it a challenge for girls of moderate strength, of moderate physical ability to excel. Make a living? Perhaps. But excel at the highest levels? I don't think so. I think the Lexi Thompsons of the world are going to continue to be rewarded by the LPGA's course philosophy.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. Well, the dumpster fire that is the Matt Kuchar and El Tucan, the caddy from the Mayakoba tournament that Matt Kuchar won, has finally reached a precipice, an epic level of social media fervor that it collapsed on Kuch and he has succumbed to the pressure. What an amazing course of events over the last 5 days, Nuge. What's your take on the Kuchar event?
I'm astounded that something that wasn't a story, shouldn't be a story, became one and overshadowed the first two rounds of the PGA Tour event. This is a private matter between player and caddy. And at the time this happened last fall, the caddy was perfectly fine with where things were. And then a journalist from a monthly magazine that's struggling stuck his nose into it. It became a social media sensation. I would argue it became a social media shaming event. And a relatively good guy on the PGA Tour had his reputation wounded badly over a private matter. I think it's a really shameful event in the world of golf journalism, and I know that I'm not alone in saying and thinking that.
And it's interesting because there's a lot of people that are giving credit to Tom Gillis, PGA Tour player, for kind of leaking the story. And in a post that he had on his social media site, he just kind of had a little token grin about it, as if he played a role in it. A little Magnum PI there that I think that's going to come back to home. Of course, he's not going to play on the tour that much, if at all, anymore. But that does not bode well for his golf legacy either.
Well, I'm presuming, Virgil, that this is a family-oriented golf radio show on Saturday morning in Nashville, so I'm going to be very careful of my choice of words when I ask the question, who is Tom Gillis?
Yep, you're right. But it's a very interesting world that the PGA Tour players live in, and sometimes jealousy is a really unbelievable thing to cope with. And it's so unbelievable.
It's really an unfortunate episode, a black eye for the tour, a black eye for Matt, unfortunately, a black eye for the journalist who stuck his nose into something that has nothing to do with happening with inside the ropes in Los Angeles. A black eye for the media generally. Nobody wins in this story, including the caddy. He may get his $50,000, and to be sure, it appears that that's a lot of money for him. But can money buy you happiness? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. As we finally get to talk about golf, and really one of my favorite golf courses in the world is Riviera, and it's just getting pummeled by rain. About every 12 years, it gets a lot of rain, which is, I guess, good. in some ways out in California, but it's definitely rained on Tiger Woods' parade. It definitely looks as if after 30 holes, that 43 years old is pretty, that's pretty hard on a man, especially when it's cold and rainy. 4-3 putts in his opening round. That's only the second time that's ever happened in his career. And, you know, we're really kind of hoping to see him break through Riviera, as it's the only golf course he's not won at when he's played it more than five times. But it doesn't look to be Tiger Woods' week either. As you watch what's going on at Riviera, speak to Tiger Woods and what you see happening this week.
Yeah, I watched a fair amount of it yesterday, and I thought to myself, geez, if putting is that hard on the PGA Tour, something's gone awry. Tiger's golf swing looks sound, and he looks to be in great shape. But he hasn't made a putt, and neither did Rory McIlroy. And McIlroy missed a bunch of putts that were close. You or I could have shot 66 if we had Roy's approach shots into the greens yesterday. But it does appear that at this point in his career, that the combination of wet and cold is a bad cocktail for Tiger Woods. It's inexplicable why he's never won on this golf course. It's inexplicable why he's never really done well at Riviera, especially having, I think he made his debut there as a kid, didn't he?
Yep, that's correct. Mm-hmm.
It's a great golf course, to your point. It's being slaughtered this week, and the scores, should they finish on time, and that's not obvious, are going to be ridiculously low, which is unfortunate, but the greens offer no resistance right now. You hit it to a number, and it stops at that number, and if you can make a putt, you're going to shoot, you know, low scores. 10 under is leading, and that's not even after the second round has been completed. They still got a lot of guys out on the golf course.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
It's a great mystery why Tiger's never done well here, and it doesn't look like this is going to be the week either.
You know, my previous guest was on, and he had two really interesting stats that were really telling. In the events that Tiger Woods has played, he is third in strokes gained against the median for his entire career, but yet has never won. Think about that. That's unbelievable. And that because the green, his biggest weapon is his iron play, arguably the greatest iron player of all time, but because it has the greens generally that people on that event hit 8% less greens in regulation as a whole, it takes away some of his advantage. But still, the fact that he is third in all of the history of his events that he's played there in strokes gained against the middle of the field that he's never won, that's a pretty interesting story right there.
Well, it is. And what's, you know, what underscores the story this week, this tournament was elevated, and it's now reached the status of the Arnold Palmer Invitational in Bay Hill and the memorial of Jack Nicklaus in Columbus. This is now an invitational event that Tiger's people run, and the Tiger's charity is going to be the principal beneficiary. So, you know, this is Tiger's event for the rest of his life, apparently. And yet it's not a tournament that's been associated with his greatness. He's never really done anything of consequence. So it's really kind of a discordant situation here. And there's no reason to think that that's going to change. This week, it's certainly the cold and the weather that's probably hurting, but it's his short stick as much as anything that's hurting him.
Yeah, no question. Well, how do you see Monday's headlines reading on the Global Golf Post, Nuge?
Well, it's hard to pick a winner when the second round hasn't been completed. I think I'm going to go, as I typically do, with emotion. I think it's going to say JT. I think Justin Thomas is in good form, but it's going to be a great battle between he and Adam Scott, it looks like, for the rest of the weekend. And let's just hope that we get it finished on Sunday and not have to wait till Monday to find out.
I'm with you on that. I'm really impressed with the resurgence of Adam Scott. So I think it will definitely come down to he and JT, and I'm with you. I think Justin Thomas gets his first win of the year, and I think that leads him to possibly winning the first major of the year, too. So I'm kind of excited about the prospects of JT. How can my listeners get in touch with you, Nuge, and get a hold of the Global Golf Post and Global Golf Post Plus?
You can get a free subscription to our Monday digital magazine, Global Golf Post, at globalgolfpost.com. We'll tell you everything you need to know about what happened in a really wacky week in golf with Matt Kuchar and Lucy Lee and perhaps Justin Thomas. And you can get a paid subscription for just $7 a month at Global Golf Post Plus, where we're going to tell you all kinds of stories on and off the course, original premium quality journalism that you can't find anywhere else.
You're the best, Nuge. I can't thank you enough for taking the time every Saturday to come on my show, buddy. Look forward to having you on next week, man.
Cheers, Virgil. Thank you.
All right, we return. We're headed to the Orca Driving Range, so stick around. You're listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone. Welcome back, and you are listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone. So this time every Saturday morning, we make the turn and decide it's a better idea to go to the range, the Orca Driving Range, where we bring the best teachers in the country in to help you with your game. And today, I'll take that spot as we discuss a really important subject when it comes to your game, and it's about club fitting. And as I'm currently, as you know, this is the time of year, all the new equipment's out. And I find it fascinating and on a bunch of different angles how many people love the game of golf and how few of them get their clubs fit for them and how that then plays a huge role in their inability to perform a swing change when they're getting their lessons and how that then makes it difficult for them to trust themselves and takes the enjoyment out of the game. And I've never ceased to amaze at the bizarreness of some of the choices that are out there. So this is really important. Like, the average driver length right now is about 45 3/4 inches long. I don't really want any of my players swinging anything longer than 44.5. That's my max number. Ricky Fowler's playing 43.5, which is really important to remember. But here's an interesting stat. Tiger Woods' driver in 2000 and Tiger Woods' driver in 2019 is 11 degrees more upright. 11 degrees more upright. So that means that his hands have to come in significantly higher than they did in his elite driving days. Not just because the driver's longer, and I think he shortened it back to 44.5. But even that's an inch longer than it was in 2000. But it's the fact that not just that, but the center of the face has to have his hands higher because the clubs are so much more upright because they're designed with a bias to help the average golfer not slice it. Well, we're starting to see a trend to flatten that out or at least have that option available. And I know that the Callaway hybrids are coming with a flat option, which is super important because for the most part, the better player, and I call the better player less than a 10 handicap, struggles with the hybrid because they generally hook it because it's set up to hook because they're trying to do whatever they can to help the average golfer not slice it. And the driver has a flat option. We have also a flat tip available, and I know that Steven, the club fitter at the Ainsworth Golf Center, and we have a flat tip available that can really change the game. So between the combination of the tip that we can flatten the head and we shorten it about an inch and a quarter from standard, that means that you can deliver the golf club similarly with your body angles coming into impact as your irons. Now, obviously, they are slightly different because the driver creates the most force and there's a lot more hip extension prior to impact with the driver than there is with a 7-iron, which helps pull the golf club up and launch it up into the air. But not 11 degrees. So I'm encouraging you, if you love the game, to make sure that you've got golf clubs that are fit for you. Not just lie angle, shaft flex. One of the things that I've learned from a good friend of mine, Tim Sigarich, was the grip size is super important as well. And to know that if it doesn't sit correctly in your hands, usually they're too small. In my history of watching this, they're too small. Sits a little bit too far down in the fingers, which increases wrist tension, which then makes it harder to load and unload the shaft properly, which makes it difficult for the club to shallow correctly. And there's a lot of moving parts to shallowing the shaft. But nevertheless, getting your grip size correct, getting the length of the golf club set up correctly with the appropriate stiffness so that the club shaft delivers the energy on the ball, not before, which is super critical. All of these things play a huge role in your ability to consistently deliver the golf club into the golf ball. So take that into consideration as you're getting ready to get your game tuned up for the season that's about ready to be upon us. And remember that the getting club fit is almost as important as the information that you pay for to get a golf lesson. When we return, Scott Wilkerson is going to join us, and we're going to talk about what it's like to be on tour working with the best players and getting their drivers fit. So stick around. You're listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone. It's time to finish strong, and you are listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone. Joining me now is the PGA Tour rep for U.S. Team Amaya, Scott Wilkerson. Scott, how are you today, buddy?
Hey, Virgil. Doing great, buddy. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Well, I think it's always fun to have people that are consistently on the driving range with the PGA Tour players to figure out what it is that they're doing, because it's so intriguing to watch the best players each year, especially this time of year with all the new equipment that's coming out. And I know that you have a new shaft coming out that it helps people get a little bit more out of their driver in fairway woods. When it comes to working with the tour players, how difficult is it to get them to mess around with shafts with their current drivers?
It's kind of difficult, but there's obviously a lot of shaft companies out there, and everyone's trying to get their stuff in play. So you have to pay attention. And generally we're looking for guys that are maybe fighting the driver a little bit or looking to make a change. And sometimes it's simply the golf course they're playing, you know, maybe it's a drier golf course. They need the ball to roll out some, so they may change some things based on that. So it's ever changing, I guess, is how you could say it.
That's interesting that shafts can make that big of a difference between, like this week where it's like a swamp out in California and in Riviera, they'd be trying to maximize their carry all the way as much as they possibly could. And the very next week they could be playing, you know, the Hondo, where it's baked out, dry, windy, and they're trying to keep it low and get more run out. How do shafts do that for the average listener out there? How is it possible that shafts can make that big of a difference?
It's more than what most people think. They think about loft and adjusting head and that kind of stuff. So mainly flex is obviously super important, and you know, we start to deal with details with these guys because obviously they're really, really good. So small changes make a big difference for them. So shafts that are maybe a little stiffer in tip section or a little stiffer in midsection or a little stiffer in the butt section can always change ball flight. So we start to look at, again, how guys load the shaft, how it performs based on their swing and individually their swing. So there's a lot of little things that go into it, but it can greatly affect, you know, what the ball flight looks like for them and where they're playing is, it makes that important.
It's a business decision every week.
It is. It is.
It's interesting, you know, working with UST Mamaya, which is one of the bigger shaft company names out there, and you've had a shaft that's been so integral to driver shaft performance over the last 10 years, but you got a new one coming out, and I find it fascinating because there's going to be some different launch and spin characteristics that go with the shaft. Give us the info on the new shaft and how those properties go into play so that we can understand how we can take our driver game to the next level.
Okay. Yeah. We always evaluate each year what the new driver heads are doing, because as you know, those things change every year also. The trend has been lower spin on almost everything, golf ball, head, shafts, everything. But we're starting to see a little bit of a trend, slight trend back towards creating some spin in the game, because guys are wanting to shape it and be able to hit draws and fades and that kind of stuff. So we started working with some of the OEM heads, Titleist, Callaway, you know, on and on, TaylorMade, those guys, to figure out what they're bringing next. And we're about a year out, so we're working with their next year product. This year we discussed a lot with the OEMs and did some testing with their heads and come up with our new shaft called Link, L-I-N-Q is how it's spelled. I'll give you a quick history on how we came to that. It was, and again, we start a year out and we start discussing, you know, the shaft sort of links the hands to the head. So that's where that came from. Again, we listen to what the OEMs say because, and their fitters on tour, basically because those guys are the ones that we have to get the shafts to get their interest. So those guys were asking for something simple. This year we did Simply Colors, Link Black and Link Purple, the two shafts. And again, we did that because it's easy to remember. And probably, as you know, Virgil, most guys can't remember the PT6F5, whatever that is. they remember, oh, I have that blue shaft, or I have that purple shaft, or I have that black shaft. So that's where we came to the simplicity of that. But basically, the purple is a mid-launch, mid-spin. The black is a low launch, low spin. And then we have one called Attas, A-T-T-A-S, that is a higher launch, mid spin. So with those combinations, we can do some tipping and you know, with, again, we have to consider, the length, the lie, you know, the weight plays a huge role. So there's a lot of factors when fitting and when building shafts for tour that we consider.
Talk to my listeners real quick about the weight of shafts and the importance of, although you may swing a 60 gram shaft faster in a fitting or at the store, how that might not be enough on the golf course, and how making sure you get the weight right, because a lot of people are trending towards lighter because it makes them swing faster, but they might lose a little control. Talk to us about the importance of weight.
Certainly. Yeah. This, you know, we had a little bit of a trend with a shaft called Elements Helium the last couple of years, that we had four or five guys on the PGA Tour using. Now, they're going a little longer in length, and again, we're seeing a trend of OEMs making the club a little bit longer. You know, 45 and a half and up now is kind of a standard. So you have to be careful with, like you said, as you go down in weight, the tendency is for couple things to happen. Torque goes up in a shaft, which allows that club head to rotate more, and you can sort of lose a little bit of the feel of the head weight during the swing too. So we consider and it's sort of an old standard, but 60 to 65 in the driver, 70 75 and 3 wood, and so on. But we also will have to consider length. And when you start to get shorter with some guys actually still do play it shorter. You have to consider that also when you're doing weight. So the purple link shaft, we sort of fought this battle, but we came in at 65, 75, 85. And then in the black, the link black, we came in at 69, 79, and 80 now, which is a little bit heavier shaft, but we control spin that way with weight also. So that's a little bit on that side of it, is how weight affects, you know, how you feel the head of the golf club too.
Yeah, I think that it's important for the listener out there to understand the importance of spin. Like, in some ways, we're generally looking for between 2,200 and 2,600, no more than 2,800 with the driver. But the average golfer would probably be benefited with a higher launch, less spin possibility, because they're not worried about working the golf ball. They're worried about finding it, and the least Absolutely. Amount of spin we could put on it would be beneficial. It's only at the higher levels and the higher club head speeds where the spin starts to come back into play, because at the end of the day, a person who hits it as far as Rory and Cameron Champ and Dustin and Bubba and what have you, there aren't many holes where they can hit it 390 straight, you know, so they need to be able to curve it. And I think that's important for people to understand about the spin. In the last 2 minutes that we have here, talk to us about the importance of understanding the spin and what's best for them.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. We, you know, it's sort of, again, most of my work is done with 2% of the best players in the world. So it's a different, they don't worry about straight so much. You know, it's more about something fitting their eye. So for the average player, you know, and I fall right into that category. I work towards launching it as high as I possibly can, with the lowest amount of spin that doesn't get too low. Like you said, somewhere between 23 and 26, or maybe, you know, if you're hitting a fade, maybe 28, is okay. But the key, and that's what we work on mostly at UST, is keeping that spin, close together. You don't want one that spins 19 and one that spins 35. So for the average player, if you can keep the loft up, and I'm talking, you know, 15 and above, and maximize spin 23 to 26 at the speed that we're swinging, you're going to maximize your distance. And that's kind of, you know, what the average golfer hopefully is trying to do.
Well, that's fantastic. Scott, thank you so much for taking the time to join me on a busy Saturday. I know you spend a lot of time on the road, so thank you for coming on my show. Look forward to seeing you soon, buddy.
You got it. Thanks, pal.
Well, thank you for making us part of your Saturday morning, because without you, there is no talking golf. For my guests, Jim Nugent, Jake Nichols, and Scott Wilkerson, thank you for making it such an entertaining show for me, and thank you for listening. Look forward to seeing what happens at Riviera this week, and we'll be back for more Talking Golf next Saturday.